The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Hannah Devlin. Coming up on the show, could extinct species like mammoths and saber-toothed tigers be brought back to life? Is de-extinction scientifically viable? And why would scientists even want to bring back long-dead species? We speak to Beth Shapiro, evolutionary biologist and pioneer in ancient DNA research. Plus, scientists discover the oldest known stone tools. And some good news for Jodrell Bank. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Beth Shapiro is an evolutionary biologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book, How to Clone a Mammoth, takes us through the controversial process of de-extinction, from how you would go about it, to which species might be restored, and if you got to that stage, where you might put them. Beth joins me in the studio, along with biologist and writer Simon Watt, and the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee. Beth, I'd like to start with the title of your book. There was a news story in March this year suggesting that researchers at Harvard, led by George Church, had made an advance towards bringing back the mammoth. Could you just tell us a bit about that and about how far along we really are?
Right. Well, when most people think about bringing back a mammoth, and the title of my book is How to Clone a Mammoth, the key word there is clone. And cloning is actually a very specific scientific technique that involves taking an animal or taking a living cell from an animal and using that cell to create an entire another living animal that's genetically identical to that particular cell. It does require a living cell, and that is something that for a mammoth we don't have, and we will never have for anything that's been extinct for a long time. The progress that's been made in Harvard recently has been to use the genome editing technology that's called CRISPR, CRISPR-Cas9 system. It's been in the news quite a lot lately because it's extremely powerful and quite scary. They were able to use this to take the elephant genome, which we have to remember is already 99% identical to a mammoth genome, and identify places in that genome where mammoths and elephants are different in some important way, and then swap them out. So cut out the elephant version of a particular gene and paste in its place the mammoth version of that gene. So what this lab at Harvard, led by George Church, has done is found 14 different genes that they believe to be different between Asian elephants, the closest living relative of mammoths, and mammoths, and then taken an Asian elephant cell and swapped in 14 mammoth genes. So what they have is a cell growing in a dish in a lab that's mostly elephant genetically and a little tiny bit mammoth. And the news, when they picked this up, took the giant leap of faith that that meant that tomorrow we were going to have a completely 100% pure mammoth wandering around, which is, of course, not anywhere near true.
I'm just going to pick you up on something you said to Nature here, which is, I probably should have called the book How One Might Go About Cloning a Mammoth, Should It Become Technically Possible, and If It Were, In Fact, a Good Idea, Which It Probably Is Not. Which I can see is not a big whizzy title.
Can you imagine trying to squeeze it onto the cover of the book as
yes.
well? Yeah, it wouldn't go down well.
So what are the technical hurdles that have to become?
Well, technical hurdles are, there are technical hurdles, there are ethical hurdles, and there are ecological hurdles. So technically, we can't actually clone elephants. There is a particular point in the elephant reproductive cycle. Actually, elephants have a hymen that grows back in between each pregnancy that actually helps to maintain the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. It's very heavy thing. You might imagine a yes. baby elephant growing up for 18 months to 2 years. It has a tiny hole in it, large enough for sperm to pass through, so an elephant can be created, but certainly not large enough for an entire developing elephant embryo to pass through. So that is one particular technical hurdle. There's also the truth that when an organism is developing within the body of its surrogate mom, it's gene expression that is eventually going to mean that it looks and acts the way that that individual does is affected by the environment in which it lives. So this developing embryo would be affected by elephant hormones and an elephant diet and elephant stressors. And so even if its genome, which remember is already pretty elephant-like, is only a little bit mammoth-like, we don't know whether or not that environment in which it's developing is actually going to negate any genetic changes that have been made by swapping out different genes. Then it would have to be born. It would, elephants, when they're born, they have, they often will consume the poo of their mom in order to set up the community of microbes that live in their gut so they can digest their food. That would be an elephant diet. We know more and more every day about how the community of microbes in our guts affects our behavior and our physiology. And of course, that would also be something important. It would have to be raised by elephants and live in an elephant environment, which brings me to what I think is the biggest problem with mammoth de-extinction, which is the ethical implications of having to use elephants. We know that elephants don't fare particularly well in captivity. They often have trouble reproducing in captivity. If they do, they sometimes injure, even kill their young. Until we know much more about how to meet the physical and psychological needs of elephants in captivity, we shouldn't be thinking about this kind of crazy scientific approach to potentially bringing something back that's not necessarily the same as something that used to be here anyway.
If you de-extinct something, or even if you reintroduce a species from captivity, I mean, one of the things you have to do is to make sure that the factors that led to its extinction in the first place no longer apply. In the case of the mammoth, was that just kind of over consuming cavemen, or was there some other ecological factor that you should also take into consideration?
The truth about what caused these megafaunal mass extinctions somewhere between 10 and 15,000 years ago is that we don't really know what the ultimate cause of these extinctions were. The genetic work is starting to show that these species started to decline in population size, in abundance. Something, if we focus on North America, because it's easier to pinpoint the timing of the initial contact with humans in North America, the decline of these populations, bison, horses, and mammoths began somewhere around 35 to maybe 40,000 years ago. That's well before the peak of the last ice age. The coldest part of the last ice age was around 20, 25,000 years ago. And it's very much well before the arrival of large numbers of humans in North America, which didn't happen until around 14,000 years ago. So the initial decline of these animals is definitely not because of interaction with humans in North America. However, it's I believe that ultimately we are probably responsible for the extinction of these creatures. I think what happens is as the climate warmed up, the amount of habitat available to these animals started to decline. They were perhaps concentrated into particular parts of the ecosystem, and that made them easy to find. So these early humans might have been there in small numbers, but going, oh, well, all the mammoths, they're up there in that particular forest. Let's just go get us a mammoth. And so maybe there were climate changes that accelerated the extinction, actually made it possible for us to kill them off. It's a long-winded way of saying both.
So is George Church doing this more out of a sort of scientific curiosity to see whether these genes can be reintroduced, or is there a real intent to try and genuinely bring back the mammoth and put it somewhere?
I don't want to speak for George, but I think he is genuinely interested in trying to bring something back. I'm not sure how far he'll push it. You know, this is in all of this stuff is entirely unfunded. The work that is going on to any of these subjects about de-extinction, any of these species, is really kind of taking place in the back corner of a lab using money that's left over from other projects being designed to do other things, just for the sake of curiosity at this point. He has cells growing in a dish in a lab, and I know he's been talking to people in zoos about the reproductive behavior of elephants, but I honestly don't know how far he intends to push this. There's a Russian scientist, Sergei Zimov, who works in northeastern Siberia. And he has been, since the mid-1990s, buying up these big plots of land. And he's called this area of northeastern Siberia Pleistocene Park. The Pleistocene was the time interval where we had mammoths and woolly rhinos and things like that wandering around, these Ice Age beasts. And he intends to have this Pleistocene Park be a place where these Ice Age creatures live freely and roam and establish this kind of Siberian tundra, the Ice Age tundra. And he has so far imported bison from Canada, horses, and about 5 different species of deer. And, you know, he's very happy up there in his Pleistocene Park trying to reestablish this ecosystem. He's shown, in fact, that having these grazing herbivores on the tundra and turning up the soil and recycling nutrients and distributing seeds has actually caused that rich grassland, that steppe tundra that used to be there, to regenerate all on its own, just having these animals there. And not only are these animals surviving the winter, having plenty of food to eat throughout the dark, cold Siberian winter, but he's seen other species like Saiga antelopes that are endangered across the Siberian tundra come to this park to eat because there's so much resource there that there just isn't elsewhere on the tundra, potentially because we are missing these herbivores that have been interacting with the landscape for such a long time.
So is this a Jurassic Park style theme park that people can visit, or is it more of a conservation project with a cool name?
I think he has hopes to make it a theme park. He actually recently bought another plot of land that's closer to Moscow and actually accessible by highway, right? And with the hopes that it will actually attract more visitors, because of course he wants to use that to raise money to buy more land. I think at the core of his plan is a conservation. It's an area of conservation to have habitat available to these different species. But he certainly sees the benefit in having people come and pay to see it, to contribute to this and actually help that plot grow.
That's ultimately what good zoos do, is that they use our fascination and our curiosity and our desire to be educated about these things to raise money to do good work. Mm-hmm. That's good zoos. And there are bad zoos out there, unfortunately.
Shouldn't we clone a saber-toothed tiger and put it in and then we'll get a really good movie out of it?
Absolutely.
You know, when it breaks loose and it all goes wrong.
It's funny, I think one of the reasons people always choose mammoths when you ask them what species they'd like to bring back is because, firstly, because we can't clone dinosaurs, and I think everybody would rather have a dinosaur. But the next best thing to a dinosaur is a mammoth, because it's big, it's kind of hairy, it probably won't eat us, you know, mm-hmm. So there's really no fear of mammoths. When you start talking about saber-toothed cats, people get a bit crazy.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I mean, if a mammoth, from what you were describing very eloquently, is a very difficult animal to think about cloning and bringing back from extinction. What would be a lot easier? I mean, it might be boring, but there's an easier place to start from.
I think easier to start might be something like, there are species that we scientists have been working with for many years as something we call model organisms, something that we can work with in a lab where we really understand their genetics and their reproductive behavior and everything that it takes to have one of these animals live and grow. These are things like rats and mice and things that the general public might not find particularly interesting. One of the candidate species that I like to think about in terms of what might be feasible, I'll talk about whether it's a good idea or not in just a moment, but feasibility in any case is there are these little guys called kangaroo rats that are going extinct across their range in kind of the desert southwestern part of the U.S. These kangaroo rats are tiny little environmental engineers. They make these deep burrow systems and they dig around, and by doing so, they disturb the vegetative community. There are lots of particular species of trees. Other small mammals and insects use these burrows as nests. Different species of bird come to feed on the trees. And as these things go extinct, which they're doing because of land use changes by humans and expanding cities and things like that, there's this domino effect of extinction where all of the things that made up this ecosystem disappear. The birds stop coming because the plants are replaced by one particular species that only has the size of seeds that most of the birds can't use. The soil things, the little burrows disappear entirely. And simply by replacing these things, which are going extinct now, before the ecosystem has a chance to change, could actually stop this domino effect of extinctions from happening. Problem is that while the kangaroo rats might be interesting and environmentally a good idea to keep around, people don't care as much about something that's tiny and you can't really see.
They're quite cute.
I'm sure they were. They are.
Well, sorry.
You mentioned in your book another project called the Lazarus Project, and this is looking at bringing back a frog that went extinct a lot more recently. Could you just tell us a little bit about that and whether you think that might succeed?
Right. This is an Australian group that is working on resurrecting a frog called the Lazarus frog, or a gastric brooding frog. There are a couple of different species of them, and they are they're both extinct. They would lay eggs and swallow them, and the frogs would develop in the stomachs of the parents. They would kind of barf them up when they were fully formed. And so it's an awesome way of protecting your offspring from being consumed, as long as you can keep yourself from being eaten.
Sounds very Australian to me, but
but really, obviously, fascinating creatures. And they have some frozen remains, completely frozen remains, because they went extinct very recently. And we had a TEDx program at National Geographic headquarters a couple years ago, and they announced during that program that they had gotten some cells to start to divide again. But unfortunately, that's as far as it ever went. And I think they're still working on trying to revive these cells, but I don't think they've made much progress. Once things are dead, the DNA starts to decay. And once it starts to break down, it's very hard to jumpstart that process of life again.
Have there been any success stories to date where we've managed to bring back an animal from extinction?
The closest success story is probably the Bucardo. This is a type of mountain goat that lives in the Pyrenees, or lived in the Pyrenees. And this animal, the last living individual, Celia, died in the early 2000s. But before she died, they captured her and managed to take a few cells and grow these in culture and use these cells to clone, the standard process of cloning, like brought us Dolly the sheep in the mid-1990s, another goat, or ibex. And this animal, the identical clone, was born, but had a massive lung deformity and died within 10 minutes of being born. So this kind of is a success story that didn't require any genome editing or gene swapping, because we could use the traditional process of cloning, but did actually bring this animal back to life for a few minutes. We've been talking a lot about animals, but there has been a pretty interesting success story with plants as well. The American chestnut tree has been extinct, kind of. What happens is the trees grow. There are still root systems that are alive in the ground, and they grow shoots. But as soon as they reach a certain diameter, a fungus infects them, and they die. So the trees haven't been able to establish, you know, large adult trees for hundreds of years. But there's a group led by a guy called Bill Powell that have been working on genetic modifying these trees so that they're resistant to the fungus. And they have been able to create types of these trees that are capable of growing and withstanding this fungus by inserting genes from Chinese chestnut trees, and are working right now on being able to release these trees into the wild.
How do you respond to the criticism that, given that the rate of extinctions that we've got at the moment, with species going extinct daily, trying to de-extinct something is not quite really the right approach? We should be doing the battle, to stopping the extinctions themselves.
I absolutely agree. I think that the technology that would be required to be developed to bring an extinct species back to life is probably best used not to resurrect something that's gone, but as a potentially new weapon in what should be a growing arsenal against the ongoing extinction crisis. What if we could use this technology not to bring something back that's gone, but to use these adaptations that evolution shaped in past to help kind of give a genetic booster shot, if you will, to species or populations that are in danger of going extinct today. One example that I like to use here is the black-footed ferret, which is going extinct across the central plains of North America. They were believed to be extinct for some time. There was a massive extermination project because they were kind of annoying little things. But they found a population, one surviving population. Unfortunately, this one surviving population had been through a very tight genetic bottleneck. They're genetically almost identical to each other. And now there's a disease that's killing them. So what if we could, and we can't, right? So we'll say that up front. But what if we could use this technology to look at the genome sequences of black-footed ferrets that are in museum collections or at the Frozen Zoo, this fantastic place in San Diego that's been collecting these specimens for decades of frozen tissue specimens? They have black-footed ferrets in their collection from prior to this population bottleneck, when there was more diversity in the population, and identify regions of the genome that provide some diversity in the immune response to invading pathogens, and then use this DNA swapping technology to replace some of the parts of the genome of the genetically identical black-footed ferrets with previously living black-footed ferret immune response parts of their genomes. giving them a little bit of genetic diversity where it might do them some good, give them a fighting chance at surviving. This kind of approach is what I think the most interesting and useful application of this insane technology might be.
Insane.
It's insane. It is. I mean, if you think about the idea that we might, I mean, we do a lot of genetic modification of things, and often what we're doing is guessing. Well, there's this backbreeding program to try to bring the auroch back in the Netherlands, and they look at different species of cow, and they say, well, that one looks a bit like an auroch in this way, and this other guy looks a bit like an auroch in another way. Let's breed them together and hope that the DNA comes together in just the right way to make this thing look the way it should, right? But if we know what genome sequences, what the actual DNA sequences that provide the forward-shaping horns or the strange hump on the back are, it's much faster and much easier to just snip it out and stick it in, and then you actually have created that change rather than waiting potentially many generations and creating lots of animals that maybe actually less fit in that environment.
Well, I'm just thinking about Neanderthals, because we all have about 3-4% of our Neanderthal genes, those of us who live out, our origins are from outside Africa, but it's a different 3-4%. Do you think we could backbreed human beings to produce a Neanderthal that way? He said, knowing the answer has to be no.
This is actually a question that a lot of people have been asking. And it turns out that we do have randomly bits of Neanderthal. It's something between 1% and 4% in each person, and it's random bits. But there are parts of our genomes that are not random. Yeah. There are some parts of the Neanderthal genome that have actually gone to relatively high frequency in humans, suggesting that there is some fitness advantage, some benefit to having that bit of Neanderthal DNA. It's very rare, but there are some parts of the genome, and there are a couple of labs working on identifying those. And there are other parts of the genome where there is no Neanderthal, against what the background amount of Neanderthal should be, which suggests that these are parts of the genome that we didn't like. We couldn't tolerate the Neanderthal version of those genes. And so
we just had a better bit.
We just had a better bit. That's right.
Yeah.
And so we purged that from early on after the hybridization event between Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans. So we probably couldn't backbreed a Neanderthal entirely.
Simon, you've written quite a lot about what's wrong with conservation at the moment. I'd be interested in what you made of de-extinction and whether you think it might play a role in the future.
Well, I'm right behind Beth in thinking that it is not currently technologically possible even. And also the kind of ethical issues, whenever we have to look at the crisis facing our biodiversity, it is much, much wiser to invest in the species and in the ecosystems and in the habitats that we currently have, rather than trying to bring back things. Now, very often if I'm doing a talk and I ask people, would you like to clone a mammoth? The answer is yes, but the answer is yes because it's cool, because people want to. They'd love to see something like this. It's still impractical. And I guess a lot of my work is trying to make people see that the species that we don't see or that we don't care about are just as worthwhile. If it came to getting some things de-extinct, what we're probably looking at is species that we currently have that are disappearing. If estimates like 200 to 250 species died every single day are real and right, then perhaps the first things that we'll successfully really get going from cloning will be species that we currently have that are on the brink. Maybe we'll bring back a silverback when it's gone. Maybe we'll bring back a tiger when it's gone. More likely, we'll start with something small, something amphibian, something where we've got like a good knowledge of the genetics. Creatures a bit like the gastric brooding frog.
Isn't there also a risk of complacency too, that if we think we've got the tools to just bring things back, we can relax and let things go extinct in the knowledge that if we want it again, we've got the tools to make it happen?
Yeah, I've heard kids actually using that exact phrase whenever I've been doing work in schools. And it's terrifying because they don't see the worth of species. And actually, that's a hard kiss to make, full stop. We have to get better, perhaps, in making arguments as to why biodiversity is necessary and why it works, because you get a certain amount of amnesia. Every generation that comes along only knows the species that are there then. Mm-hmm. They don't appreciate the massive crisis that has gone before. They see it that things are getting worse now, but then when the next generation comes along, they don't know what's been lost already. So every new set of people doesn't know how bad it has been and how bad it is getting.
I don't think de-extinction necessarily changes this problem, though. I think I've also heard this idea that if we can bring something back, will people just stop caring? And I think that assumes both a wonderful thing and a really terrible thing about people. The wonderful thing it assumes is that people generally do care. And I think, like Simon's just said, people don't generally care about extinction in as much as it doesn't actually affect them personally. The, the terrible thing that it assumes is that those of us who do care are all of a sudden going to suddenly stop doing so if some crazy science fiction thing becomes possible to bring something back that's not necessarily the exact same thing as something that was there in the first place. And
even if we have a purely economic argument on it, it's cheaper to keep things alive than to have to work out how to bring them back.
Yeah. Absolutely. One hope that I have with de-extinction, and another argument that I often hear against this, is aren't you taking money away from conservation, which is in dire need of money? And I don't think that we are, because conservation is a very personal thing. It's very hard to get somebody who wants to save the snowy owl to care about saving the gastric brooding frog, and you couldn't get someone who wants to invest in saving polar bears to invest in amphibian research. And I hope, and I don't know if it's true, but I would hope that the idea that there might be some crazy tech solution to biodiversity decline might actually attract new sources of funding, perhaps from people who really like the idea of fancy tech solutions to a big problem, and get more people interested in the idea of conserving biodiversity.
But also from what you're saying, that most of the work is actually sort of stuff, as you said, a little bit of money left over from another project. He's not taking money away from conservation, is he?
No, not at this point. We kind of thought, you know, there's an organization called Revive and Restore that's based out of San Francisco that is trying to think about using new technologies like de-extinction to revive and restore ecosystems in the present day. And they thought initially that they would have a great, easy time raising money from Silicon Valley for de-extinction because it's such a fancy and fun idea. And people love to come and hear about it, but it's been very hard going to raise any money at all. And I think it's because it's just not possible. The feasibility is so poor that these people who are used to investing in things that are about to work are going, well, yeah, come back to me when it's real.
But money's a problem in general when it comes to conservation, because the thing is, of course, we need more money, and we're always going to need more money.
Yes.
That's kind of the real problem, is that it's a bottomless pit.
Talk to me, I work for The Guardian.
But we're not ever going to have a solution monetarily.
Yeah.
So what we actually really need to do, I think, in conservation is not just talk about it as a charity thing. We have to talk about it as something that is essential. And we have to talk about it in terms of being able to hold corporations to task for environmental crime, being able to get political on it, I guess.
It's putting a price on nature and saying this is nature, this is...
And the people who dislike the notion of putting a price on nature, because there's a lot of people who don't like ecosystem services and ideas like that, which try to monetize species or put a monetary value at, the people who want to give to the snow leopard, who want to look after species, they're already convinced. They're already on the conservationists' team. The people that we need to get hold of are the people who are making the decisions. We have to have a government who's willing to put their voice behind this as well.
Tough luck.
Yes.
It's interesting that even the projects that are seen as really cool and flashy, you know, bringing back an iconic species like the mammoth, even those are having problems raising money. And I don't know, I mean, that's perhaps why sometimes conservation projects have focused so much on the single species. And it seems as though you're saying, Simon, that's... we should move away from that approach, and we should be focusing more on the general issue of biodiversity rather than just talking about pandas and polar bears all the time.
Yeah, well, yes and no. And I suppose I make I run a comedy night where we are frequently just taking the mickey out of the panda, and I love it and enjoy it. And one of the reasons we do that is because no matter what we say, we are not going to put a dent in the panda's popularity. But again, the people who are convinced and behind the panda, they know what they're doing. I remember doing a debate once on the BBC with Colin Butfield, who's one of the heads of public engagement at the WWF. Basically, he was saying, look, we have to protect the panda because it is the poster boy. We use the money that we raise from the panda to conserve its habitat. And in doing that, we conserve all the other species that live in the habitat. And then I said how we have to educate ourselves more widely, that we don't just focus on these species, but we see all the smaller ones. And what you had there was two reasonable men agreeing, and it made for such awful television. So the thing is, we need to have both arguments, and we need to have both arguments all the time. This is not a problem that's going away. So I would rather that we keep giving to charity, but also that we arm ourselves with education, with knowledge, to try and look into techniques like de-extinction, like ecosystem management, to know that the habitat matters more than the creature, I guess.
How to Clone a Mammoth by Beth Shapiro is published now by Princeton University Press, and Simon Watts's The Ugly Animals, We Can't All Be Pandas is also out now.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it.
With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Okay, Hannah, what's caught your eye this week?
There's a fascinating paper in Nature this week which describes the discovery of some new stone tools that have been found in Kenya. And these date to 3.3 million years old, which is about 700,000 years older than the oldest tools that we'd previously found. The really intriguing thing about this is that it takes us back way beyond the Homo genus from which humans are ultimately descended. We think that began about 2.5 million years ago. And so we're looking at ancient apes that we previously thought were pretty primitive, were maybe still living in the trees part of the time, had these really flat faces and long arms, nothing that you'd really recognise as human. And it just raises questions about what it really is that made us special, because for so long tool use has been seen as one of those crucial things that distinguished humans from the other lines that were around at the time.
There's a really tricky bit with this, which is that we find stone tools, we don't find wooden tools, we don't find other tools which would decay and disappear. So tool use might even be much, much older than this. Who really knows? And we know that crows use tools, we know that chimpanzees use tools. It's something which you find showing up in a lot of animals and in a lot of lineages. So these are not even necessarily our ancestors. They could just be another ape-like thing, which is quite handy.
Of course, also there's a distinction between tool use and tool making. Tool use is one thing where you just go, oh, that'd be useful, and I'll smack him in the head with this. But these are shaped tools, were they? Did they actually make them, or are they just a sort of random, that looks useful kind of aspect to them?
Yeah, so this was quite a collection of tools, and from what they can see, they were things that were made using a hammerstone and anvils, and they were more sophisticated than the kind of things that chimpanzees use at the moment. So they tend to use just big stones to crack things with that they've mostly just picked up from the ground. So I think we're looking at something that's a stage of sophistication beyond that. But it's true that it's very hard to know exactly how they were made and what they were doing with them. The researchers did try on site to kind of reproduce it themselves and look at how they were, how they might have chipped away at the stones to shape them. But there's going to be an element of that that's a mystery.
Got to stick up for our own species for a minute and point out just that there's yet to be another species discovered that's capable of making airplanes and locomotives. So clearly there is something different about us than these other
species. I don't know, because I think it's just using the same stuff but taking it on with the legacy of culture. You know, we're just making... Well, I'm sticking up for chimpanzees, basically, because they do adapt up things and sort of growth.
What makes humans different from chimpanzees, and one is big brains, stand upright, and we make tools. The tool making starts much earlier than we think, and the big brains come very, very late. So that sort of it's setting something in train that we're seeing in these African finds, which are absolutely, sounds absolutely fantastically interesting to me. And why we stood upright, of course, remains another mystery. But the end result, and it's only very recently, have our brains in the last 250,000 years achieved the actual incredible complexity that we've got now that allows us to make planes and trains
and have language.
Which is the real one, isn't it?
Yeah, the transmission of the information. So it's not just making tools, it's being able to teach others to make tools,
right,
and be able to extrapolate from the tools that you've already made.
There's sometimes been an assumption that all these things that made us special, language, big brain, standing up, all emerged in a single, neat, punctuated
package. Yeah.
And this really suggests that's not how it happened.
No.
Robin, I think you've got some funding news that caught your eye.
Yes, it's a big turnoff, isn't it? Funding news.
Some exciting news about Jodrell Bank.
It's the same thing. It's just that the Heritage Lottery Fund are giving a lot of money to science and technology parts of our heritage, including money for the Lovell Telescope. That's a big iconic radio telescope at Jodrell Bank that Bernard Lovell created just after the war. he was a war researcher, noticed that he was getting funny signals from outer space, built this huge telescope, and people wondered what use it was. And then the Russians launched the Sputnik, and he was the only person in the West that could track this thing. He was a great man, Sir Bernard, and I just think it's really great that this is going to remain not a decaying blot on the Cheshire landscape, but a really bright, shiny object. Other good news, money going to big medical collection at the Science Museum, which is terrific. My own favourite, a new railway museum on the Great Central Railway. I'm just a boy that likes trains, you know.
And that's all we've got time for this week. Big thank you to Beth Shapiro, Simon Watt and Robin McKee. From me, Hannah Devlin, and all at the Science team, thanks for listening.